my brother and sister-in-law and, you know, Hannah Berner, her
Yeah.
daughter in Baltimore, they were turned away. They had appointments and they were turned away.
Because they didn't have enough?
I think it must have been because they probably canceled yesterday. So the people who had appointments today, I guess, had got their appointments.
Yeah, did you get an appointment yet, Brenda?
I did.
Oh, good.
And through Montgomery County.
Oh, very good.
Yeah,
good.
The first one.
Good.
Rabbi.
Hello.
Hi, Rabbi.
How's everybody doing?
Oh, good.
Talking vaccines, I hear.
Vaccines. What else is there to talk about?
Yeah.
We had ours a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, Israel is way ahead of Montgomery County.
Israel is, yeah. Yeah.
We also had 75 degree weather today.
Wow.
Thank you for sharing.
It was sunny.
Encouraging us all to move.
It's a good day for a bike ride.
But Ben Gurion is closed. You can't even go there now.
I'm here.
No, Dr. Weiss and Hillel are supposed to go to Israel and they couldn't go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
They sold their apartments. And they have to rent for, you know, a month or so with the new people.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Interesting.
Okay. So besides vaccines, we could discuss Torah. That's the other topic we could discuss.
Ooh, okay.
That's a good idea.
That's still there. So if you're in your Stone Chumash, page 213, Perek Lamed Tes, chapter 39, and we'll pick up with the story of Yosef. So we discussed the sale of Yosef. We discussed how he got on his brother's nerves, what he did that may have somehow rationalized in their own mind this action to sell him. We discussed last week the actual sale, what actually transpired at the sale of Yosef. Now the next step in the story is Yosef in captivity. Yosef's going to be a slave and then he's going to be a prisoner before he becomes a king. So he's on quite a journey right now. So I want to look today at the story of Yosef being sold to slavery and his experience as a slave. So we finished Perek Lamed Zayin, and it said that Yosef was sold. It was very unclear in the Psukim who bought him, who sold him, to whom he was sold. You know, and Rashi says that he was bought and sold several times before finding his final master in Egypt. So at the end of chapter 37 says that the Midianites sold him to Mitzrayim. The beginning of chapter 39 speaks about how he was brought down to Egypt, to Mitzrayim, and he was purchased from the Ishmaelim, the Ishmaelites. So again, unclear the exact order of who owned him, who sold him, but the bottom line is he was tossed around a bunch of times prior to being purchased by Potiphar. If you look at Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, it says that he was bought by Potiphar, who was, in Hebrew, the Sris Paro, Sar HaTabachim, which the English translation says a courtier of Paro, the chamberlain of the butchers. So it's actually a dispute amongst the commentaries. What does the phrase Sar HaTabachim mean? What was Potiphar's role? Potiphar was certainly somebody of the royal household. He certainly had a job, you know, a government job, a powerful government job. So one approach is that he was the chief butcher, which is the approach the Arch School translation takes over here. He was the chamberlain of the butchers. He was the chief butcher for Paro. The other way to look at it, some say he was the chief executioner, a little more scary, right? So Tabachim could be the chief butcher or the chief executioner. It's not that relevant, I don't think, to the story at the moment, but either way, Potiphar was of a royal position. He was somebody who was very powerful and wealthy and of the royal court of Paro. Now, why is that significant? I mean, the fact that he was bought by somebody of royalty, we don't even think twice about that. But the truth is, any wealthy Egyptian could have purchased a slave. I mean, slavery was something that was common then. There was a slave market. If you had money, you could purchase a slave. The fact he's purchased by royalty is actually a very significant point. And the Nitziv explains the following. He says that we view this as part of the miracle over here. This was divine providence. It was hashkacha from Hashem. Why is that? Because being sold to royalty is how Yosef ended up with the royal prisoners in jail later on in the story. That's why he met Paro's chief butler and chief baker. And that's why the chief butler was able to put in a good word to Paro and have Yosef freed. I mean, if you were to connect the dots of the story, had Yosef been sold to some commoner, he wouldn't have ever interacted with Paro's royal cabinet, his royal servants. and had even if he's thrown into prison, if he's thrown into a civilian prison, then he would have just kind of languished there forever, you know, based on natural cause and effect. But the fact that Yosef was sold to royalty and ended up interacting with people in Paro's royal court, that's what actually led to Yosef's freedom at the end. So we see here certainly a piece of the hashgacha of the story of the divine providence, the miraculous chain of events, which brings Yosef from being a slave and a prisoner to being a king, as we'll see later on in the story. If we go to verse 2 and 3, let's read it together. It says, Hashem was with Yosef. He became a successful man, and he remained in the house of his Egyptian master. His master perceived that Hashem was with him, and whatever he did, Hashem made succeed in his hand. So Yosef became the slave in Potiphar's house. He became the top slave. Now, he was somebody who was very productive, very successful, and he brought on the respect of his master. It says that Hashem was with Yosef, and then it says in verse 3, the master could see that Hashem was with Yosef. I mean, there's 2 points here. The fact that Hashem was with Yosef is 1 point, and that we hope we can expect that one of the children of Yaakov, that Hashem would stay with him. But the master was able to perceive this. The master saw in some way that Yosef was connected to the divine, to God. And the question is, you know, how do we understand this? So the first point, Yosef was certainly of a higher cut. Yosef was one of the children of Yaakov Avinu, a grandchild of Abraham and Yitzchak. So Yosef was of a higher cut. He was somebody whose midos and morals, his honesty, his ethics were something that was of a different cut than the other slaves. That's number one. The Chizkuni, one of the commentaries, says that Hashem being with Yosef, what it means is that Yosef got extra divine assistance to remain strong and not to assimilate. I mean, imagine Yosef's challenge. He's cut off from his family. He's sold off into slavery in Egypt. For all he knows, he'll never see his family again. His dreams, his destiny as being one of the tribes of Israel, in his mind, are lost. I mean, there's no end in sight. So Yosef could easily have given up. He could have despaired. He could have assimilated, become just a regular Egyptian slave, and forgotten everything about that they learned in his father's household. But Hashem stayed with Yosef. He gave him this extra assistance, this divine, you know, connection, which allowed him to stay strong even during these trying times. Now, how the master noticed this? Meaning, it says that Hashem was with Yosef, but how the master see that Yosef was somebody connected to God? Like, where do you see that? Yosef didn't wear a sign. You know, I am a Jew. Like, you know, he wasn't wearing a yarmulke or a tefillin at the time. There's no talus. Like, what was it about Yosef that allowed the master to see that he was with God? So the Ramban actually says that Yosef was extraordinarily successful. I mean, Yosef wasn't just a good worker, but whatever he did, it's like this, everything he touched turned to gold. Like, Yosef's work was so successful, unusually successful, extraordinary. So the master saw something different over here. Now, the Ramban says the master at first thought that Yosef wasn't connected to Hashem. He thought Yosef knew how to do kishuf, magic. He thought he was connected to magic or witchcraft, wizardry. And through that, that's how he was so successful. But the Ramban says that it seems that Potiphar received some sort of dream or vision from Hashem to correct that point and tell him, no, Yosef is not involved in wizardry or magic. He's really somebody who's devoted to me, to God. That's why he's so successful. That's what Ramban says. Rashi and other commentators bring out some other more practical points. Rashi says that whatever Yosef did, he was constantly, he says, Shem Shemayim Shogar Befiv. He was talking about God constantly. You know, when he was asked, you know, Yosef, tomorrow, can you go and bring me my breakfast? He would say, you know, Mirza Hashem, you know, God willing, I'll be there tomorrow to bring you your breakfast. And they say, Yosef, how are you feeling today? He'd say, Baruch Hashem, I'm feeling great. Thank God. It's a Yosef, you know, well, I'll see you later. Yeah, God willing, I'll see you later. And he'd be talking about Hashem. So being that he was somebody so successful, and you could see that he was always speaking about God, you can connect the dots. And connecting the dots means this, okay, must be that this person is very, very righteous and devout, and God helps him out. So that's what Rashi explains. It made it very clear to Potiphar that Yosef's success was a result of his connection to God, because he was always talking about God. Now, it's something which, you know, we also talk about God, we hope. I mean, it's something maybe we should train ourselves to do more. But one of the ways to feel God's presence in life in a more concrete way is to make God part of the discussion. I mean, there are terms we throw out there, you know, Mirtz Hashem, Bezus Hashem, God willing, you know, those, you know, Baruch Hashem, thank God, all these things. We do say these things. If we don't really think about what they mean, then we're not really bringing God's presence to our lives. If it comes to the figure of speech, you know, you go to anybody and show, how are you feeling? Baruch Hashem, I'm feeling good. So if it's the figure of speech, it doesn't mean that much. But if you pause and think, you know, Baruch Hashem, thank God, I'm good. I'm healthy. I'm here. I'm alive. You know, you think about good things when you say it. You say, you know, God willing, and you really think, yeah, God has to, you know, we know life is very fragile. We know things happen. You know, God willing, I'll be there. So that's something that we have to train ourselves to say, but not just to say, to feel. And if you feel that, it's a very meaningful way to connect yourself more to God on a daily basis. And Yosef did this. Now, Yosef, when he said it, he meant it. When Yosef said it, Yosef really thought about Hashem. And he understood that God's role in life is vital. I need divine assistance to accomplish anything. And because of that, Yosef was able to be so successful. And his master is able to see, he was Mekadosh Shemayim, he was sanctifying God's name, because the way Yosef acted, they knew this is because Yosef is connected to God. So that's the point Rashi makes. Other commentaries will make another point based on the Medrash. The wording is, when Yosef would come and go, he was Malachish v'nichnas, Malachish v'yotze. He's whispering prayers. So it wasn't just about saying, yeah, God willing, I'll be there tomorrow to bring your breakfast. You know, thank God I'm feeling well. But he'd be constantly praying. He'd be davening all the time. And this doesn't mean, you know, that he did Shachar Mincha Maariv. What it means is that there was a constant ongoing conversation between Yosef and Hashem. So Yosef understood, I need Hashem's help throughout my day. And the way to be able to connect and to bring down help from Hashem is to pray. I have to daven. I have to be in constant connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a constant conversation. And they have the thing, constant contact. You get this email, it's constant contact. So Yosef was in constant contact with Hashem. So when he would come in the room, he'd whisper a prayer, you know, may I succeed in the task ahead of me. When he'd leave the room, he'd say, hopefully everything I did was successful. You know, please help me in my next step. And he'd be constantly praying throughout the day. But this allowed him to always be in touch with Hashem. This gave strength to Yosef to remain connected and not to despair, not to lose his faith. And this allowed all those around him to see that Yosef was of another cut. He was coming not from your regular, mundane, everyday, you know, slave, but he was actually a person who was a much higher level, much more righteous person than they ever imagined. I mean, the lessons for us, I think, on both these points are very significant. You know, we always talk about what are ways to bring Hashem more into our lives. How can you feel more connected? How can you feel more inspired? How can you feel the reality of God more on a daily basis? So one answer to that question is this idea of constantly talking about God, whether it be through prayer, whether it be through statements like, you know, thank God I'm feeling fine, Baruch Hashem, those type of statements, if you think about them. You know, prayer is not limited to what it says in your Siddur. And prayer is limited to Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, and prayer is not limited to going to Shul on Shabbos. Prayer is a constant connection between us and Hashem, and that connection allows us to be connected and to feel Hashem's presence in our lives and recognize that everything that we do requires Hashem's help. So you have to get used to it, but just to whisper, you know, you're going to the doctor, and just to whisper a short prayer, you know, Hashem, may this visit, you know, be successful, and may I be healthy. There's actually halacha, which is cited in Shulchan Aruch, that before you take medication, there's a one-line prayer to say. One-line prayer is Yiratzon, may be Hashem's will, to te esek l'refua, that this pursuit should be l'refua, should actually heal me, should be successful. Hirofei chinam ata, because Hashem, you are the one who heals. Because medications don't work, Hashem doesn't will them to work. So you say a short prayer, but that's a formal prayer. I'm saying informal prayers. So that you bring your car into the shop and you say, Hashem, please help this be an easy fix. You know, you walk into the store and you say, please make this be an easy and safe trip to the store. You know, these days, you know, we have to make sure everything is safe for us. You know, this is these short little one-line prayers, but it keeps Hashem as an active part of our lives. And it allows us to connect more. It allows Hashem to bring more of his influence, you know, into our activities. So Yosef is always talking about Hashem, praying to Hashem. And he was extraordinarily successful as a slave. So everybody saw this guy is something else. You know, he's a very righteous slave. Rav Hirsch as usual, has a very beautiful line. Rav Hirsch says, I'll read you the quote. He says, if God was with Yosef, that could only have been because Yosef was with God. If the purposes which a man strives to achieve coincide with God's purposes, then he arranges circumstances to be favorable and helpful for their achievement. Meaning if Hashem is with Yosef, it always mirrors our actions. Hashem acts as we act. If we're with Hashem, Hashem's with us. And then Rav Hirsch says that as long as our goals coincide with God's purposes, so God will help to arrange those goals to come out into fruition. I mean, God's always there to help us when our goals are in the right direction. So Yosef, his goals were correct, and he was with God. So God was with him, and God arranged circumstances to help Yosef achieve what had to be achieved. So that's verse 2 and verse 3. And this pushed Yosef to be the top of the slaves. He became the leader of all the slaves. In verse 4, it says, Yosef found favor in his eyes, and he attended him. He appointed him over his household, and whatever he had, he placed in his custody. So Yosef became in charge of the entire household of Potiphar. In verse 5, and it happened that from the time he appointed him in his house, and over whatever he had, Hashem blessed the Egyptian's house on Yosef's account. So then the Egyptian, Potiphar, saw that he himself, he was succeeding. His whole household, his business dealings, he was succeeding in everything because of Yosef. So Hashem's blessings was in whatever he owned, in the house, in the field. And this is a concept that the rabbis teach us. When there is a tzaddik around, he brings blessing to the entire city. When you live in a city with great people, so they bring down blessing into the whole city itself. So Yosef was around the house of this Egyptian, of Potiphar, and he brought blessing into the house. Verse 6, he left all that he had in Yosef's custody, and with him present, he concerned himself with nothing except for the bread that he would eat. So he had full trust in Yosef. There was nothing that Potiphar worried about in his household. He put it all into Yosef's hands. Now Yosef was handsome of form and handsome of appearance. So the end of verse 6 is something which is interesting. Meaning, until now, so Yosef was sold into slavery. Terrible. But once he got there, everything seems to be going in a positive direction for him. He's successful. God is with him. His master promotes him. He's given all this power and in the household. He's given respect. So Yosef, things seem to be coming together to some degree. Things are going smoothly. Then the pasuk inserts this funny description about Yosef's appearance. And now it says Yosef was handsome of form and handsome of appearance. So why suddenly is the Torah introducing to us Yosef's appearance? So the Netziv says the following. The Netziv says what actually relates to Yosef as a slave. Meaning typically, if you're a hardworking slave, you're not going to be looking your best. You might be a little bit haggard. You're not clean shaven. You might get some cuts and some bruises and some scars, and you're dirty. I mean, slavery is not easy work. And if you're a hardworking slave to the point that Yosef was, you think you'd walk away maybe not looking your best. But then as Siv says, the very fact that Yosef still looked so handsome, that was a sign to us his success was totally in Hashem's hands. I mean, he didn't have to work that hard, and he still succeeded. I mean, had the success come from his own personal efforts, he may not have had the appearance that he had. But being that he didn't have to work that hard, and Hashem just gave him success, so he still kept up with his appearance. He still looked nice and clean, and no bruises, and he was everything looked, his hair was still in order. Everything looked good because it was all from divine assistance. So that's what Netziv explains. Now the other way to approach this pasuk, in the way that most commentaries do, is that it introduces the next story. The next story is going to be Yosef's big challenge when Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him, and simply, it seems in the verse, because Yosef was a very handsome fellow. He was a young, strong, handsome slave. And Potiphar's wife apparently was not all that loyal to Potiphar. And she attempts to make a pass at Yosef. So that's the simple meaning of this verse. But Rashi also points out a deeper point. Rashi says, if the verse is stressing to us Yosef's appearance, this is because, Rashi says, Yosef was too concerned with his appearance. I mean, we don't like saying negative things about our great ancestors, but when the sages tell us these things, we have to understand them. Rashi says that when Yosef saw himself in control of Potiphar's household, he became a little bit arrogant, and he started, what Rashi says, is stroking his hair. He was making himself, you know, a little bit too beautiful. You know, he was forgetting that he was a slave in Egypt. He was forgetting that his brothers had sold him and that he had been sold off from his father. He was forgetting, he was a little bit too overconfident and self-absorbed at this point. And commentaries say he forgot about the fact that his father is back home mourning for his loss. He forgot about the fact that, you know, this is not where he's supposed to be. And he became a little bit too focused on his success at his job. Again, a little too, on his level, we'll call it self-absorbed, focusing on his own looks. So Hashem said, you can't forget who you are. It's a lesson, before we get to the rest of the story, it's a lesson for us as Jews in Golis, in exile. You know, we've had our difficult times in exile, and we've had our better times in exile. But if we start becoming too self-absorbed and arrogant, and we say, you know, everything is fine, we are where we're supposed to be, then Hashem says, well, I have to teach you otherwise, because this is not how life is supposed to be. You know, your father is at home crying. Hashem is crying for us in Golis, just like Yaakov's at home crying for Yosef being in Golis, Yosef being exiled. And we have to realize as Jews in exile, that we have to do our best and succeed like Yosef did, but never forget the context of where we are and who we are. So even if Yosef, you know, on his own level, in some way, just lost sight of the fact that he was a child of Yaakov and he was sold to slavery and he's meant to be one of the 12 tribes, the Shiftei Kah, and his father is at home crying for his loss. Yosef in some way forgot that point when he focused too much on himself because he was being so successful and respected as a slave. Hashem says, now we're going to have to challenge you. We'll put you to the test and things are going to be a little bit different now. So that's the introduction to the next story. So now you look at verse 7. After these things, which refers to seemingly Yosef's focus on his own appearance, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Yosef and she said, lie with me. But he adamantly refused. He said to his master's wife, look, with me here, my master concerns himself about nothing in the house and whatever he has placed in my custody. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has denied me nothing but you, since you're his wife. How then can I perpetrate the great evil and have sinned against God? So Potiphar's wife tries to seduce Yosef. Yosef adamantly refuses, as it says in the English over here, and he gives his reasoning, his rationale why he refuses. So I want to look at a few points here. Number one, just put this challenge into perspective. I mean, Yosef is a young man, a handsome young man. He's cut off from everything that he grew up with. All the different ideas of holiness and sanctity, morality that he was taught by his father, grandfather, it could be relevant to him at this point. I mean, he's totally cut off. His brothers almost killed him. They sold him as slaves. Like I said before, for all he knows, he'll never see his family again. So the challenge of now this beautiful woman comes to seduce you, he could have said, okay, what? Why am I refusing? What do I have to lose? And if they put me in jail, okay, I'm a slave anyway. It's like, you know, now he's sold into slavery to somebody else. Like what did he have to lose here? But Yosef stuck to his morals. He said, no, I'm a child of Yaakov, a great-grandchild of Yitzchak and Abraham, and I'm not going to give in. But the nisayon that he had, the challenge, was a tremendous challenge of Yosef's strength and willpower and sanctity. So that was the challenge. Now, the term that we used, so the English says he adamantly refused. The Hebrew word is vayema'ein. And for those who are familiar with the trup, with the notes, yeah, on words in the Torah, vayema'ein has on it what's called a shalshelis. A shalshelis is a very rare trup, a very rare note in the Torah. It only appears, I think, 3 or 4 times. And the shalshelis, the way it goes, is it's an up and down. It's a very long and up and down sound. So commentaries point out, what's the meaning of a shalshelis? Why is this word get a shalshelis? So there's a few approaches to this. So number one, the fact that it has this like up and down tone, it seems to connote constant refusal. This wasn't a one-time thing. We're going to see soon. She came to him day after day after day after day, and every single day he refused. He's able to hold back day after day. So even, it wasn't just a one-time thing. I'm not giving in. It was a constant challenge and pressure he had. And every time he kept refusing. That's one approach to this. Some commentaries say that this actually represents his inner struggle. The up and down in the music shows that Yosef in himself was in turmoil. Should I do it? Should I not? Should I do it? Should I not? Yes, no, yes, no. It wasn't easy for him. It wasn't like he had no desire and he just walked away without any struggle. He struggled. And it was a back and forth. It was a fight within himself, but he was always able to come out the end and say, I'm not doing it. So it shows you some of Yosef's greatness that despite that, it wasn't like he had no struggle. Despite the struggle, he still said no. And another commentary says that it connotes the strength of his refusal. The fact that Shoshal says this long note, it's like, no. It shows how, like it says in the English, how adamant he was about not giving it. So we have three different approaches over here to why there's a shalshelis on top of this word. But bottom line is, Yosef struggled. There was a major challenge of his own morality, and he was able to refuse every single day. Now, what was the excuse he gave? Now, this is interesting. So we think, you know, Yosef is a great tzaddik, and the excuse is simply, it's a sin. I can't be involved in sinful behavior. That's not what he said. That's not, if you look at what Yosef said, that's not how he responded. Yosef said, look, with me here, my master concerns himself about nothing in the house, and whatever he has, he placed in my custody. There's no greater in this house than I. He's denied me nothing but you, since you're his wife. How then can I perpetrate this great evil? And have sinned against God. The sin against God is the last thing he says. He gives a whole speech beforehand, focusing more on his own responsibility that he has within the household, his dignity. You know, he was entrusted with something. And I think it's very important. You know, on the one hand, we like to say, you know, give ourselves good religious excuse not to do things. It'd be sinful behavior. I'm a person, I have morals, and this is immoral. That's not enough for us sometimes, because we love to live with lofty ideals, but practically comes down to it. If we're given a challenge, that doesn't really speak to us. You know, yes, the lofty ideal is to do X, but okay, but it's hard for me and I'm gonna do Y. So it's a way that we could approach a challenge, but it's not always practical. The religious motivation is something which contributes to doing the right thing, but when it comes down to a hands-on challenge in life, it doesn't always speak to us. It doesn't always change us. Yosef begins with a very rational, practical response. Responsibility. You know, I've been entrusted by a master to oversee his household. You know, I have a dignity. I have dignity. I have self-worth. I have a future here as a slave to Potiphar. If I give in, what's going to happen to me? Maybe I will be executed. Maybe I'll be sold to a master who doesn't like me so much. Maybe I'll lose my position of power. And that speaks to us often much more than religious duties. So yes, the religious duties are ultimately what we're trying to accomplish. But when it comes down to being very practical about a challenge, now let's say someone's given a challenge of making a dishonest deal in their business. And they can make, you know, $5 million, but they have to cut some corners. So to say, you know, the Torah forbids you to steal, everyone knows that. That's not going to necessarily motivate this person. But to say, you know what, if you're caught, this is going to be the end of you. If you're caught, you know, your family is going to be ashamed. Your kids are going to be ashamed. Your wife's going to be ashamed. You know, your parents are going to be ashamed, whoever it is. You know, you're going to lose your business. No one's going to talk to you in shul. Like, you know, you're going to walk around, everyone's going to look at you and point, and you know, you'll be the laughingstock of town. Like, often that speaks to us much more than the fact that I have a religious duty not to steal. So ultimately, should that be motivational? No, the religious duty should be more motivational to us, but it's not. That's not practical. So, and Yosef understood that. So Yosef said that the fact that sin against God, that's the second thing he mentions. But the first thing he says is that I don't want to blow it. You know, I have a future over here. I have responsibility, I have trust, I have honor. And if I give in to this desire, I might lose all of that. And where does that leave me? It leaves me with nothing. And also it's a sinful against God. Not that it's less important, but it's less motivational at times when it comes down to practical challenge. That's what I would say. I think a good example of this, you know, Masilas Yesharim, probably the most classic Musar work. So in one of his chapters, he's trying to give, I would say, motivational points as to why one should be more careful about their service of God. And he says, okay, I'm going to give it to you from three different angles. One's only going to speak to the very righteous. One will speak to people who are sort of mediocre. And one will speak to common folk. And it's three different types of motivational points. But he understands that, yes, the ideal is that we should all want to achieve perfection. But that doesn't speak to the commoners. You know, you want to be perfect? Okay, I'm not perfect. So you can speak to a very righteous person and say, yeah, if you do this, you're not going to achieve perfection. You're not going to achieve shleimus. But he understands that that's not going to be motivational to some. You have to speak to them on their own level. And we're all like that. You know, what's motivational to one person does not motivate another. So it could all be true. It's true that it's a sin to God. It's true that he's been entrusted by a master. And if he does this, he'll be disloyal. It's true that he has a future in Potiphar's house. And if he gives in, he may lose that future. That's all true. What's going to motivate me, you know, at the time at the challenging time? So we have to know ourselves what motivates us. And usually what's more motivational is not the religious value, but what's more relational is the tangible, practical outcome of the action. So the religious value has to motivate us as well. But we understand that we have to be much more practical sometimes. Noble ideas don't always hit us at our core, like practical ramifications would. So ideas of embarrassment or losing our self-dignity or self-worth, or losing a business, or losing friends, or losing family, those often will be much more motivational to us than just saying that this is sinful. So Yosef got that, and he told her, I've been entrusted by my master with everything in the house, and I don't want to lose that. And also it'll be sinful. That's what he says. So that is up to verse 9. Verse 10. And so it was, just as she coaxed Yosef day after day, yom yom, every single day, she would come to him and seduce him. The rabbis say she would constantly be changing clothing and putting on different makeup and putting on perfume. I mean, she tried every tactic in the book to seduce him. She tried everything. But he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, to be with her. Then there was an opportune day when he entered the house to do his work. No man of the household staff being there in the house, that she caught hold of him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and went outside. So finally they came where she had her opportunity to just grab him. And it's interesting because it says he went into Losos Malach to do his work. And the rabbis say, well, what work was this exactly? So there's actually a dispute in the Gemara. What work did he go in to do? Some say he went in to do his household work. He had to, work out some bills or some, pay some bills, whatever it was he had to do. Cheshbonos, calculations. But some say he actually went in to find her. I mean, there's an opinion in the Gemara that Yosef, at a moment of weakness, actually went into the house to give in, finally, to this desire. He struggled with it for so long, he said, okay, I give up. And even so, when he went in, he was able to pull the strength together and say, no, I'm not doing it right now. But it just shows us how challenging it was. Yosef was not perfect. You know, it wasn't like Yosef had no challenge. He had a challenge. He almost gave into it. But yet, at that crucial moment, it says that he fled. He ran outside. It's important to note that it says in the pasuk, when she grabbed him, he ran. He fled. Yanas. He escaped. I mean, walking out would have done it. If he turned around and walked out casually, he would have turned right back around and went back to her. But he said, no, this is fire. And he ran away from it like you ran away from fire. That's what he did. And he ran outside. And when it comes to these types of challenges or any challenge in life, often, you know, backing away slowly doesn't pull you out of the situation. And you have to just say, no, I'm cease and desist. I am out of here. And just walk away. And Yosef, he ran out. He said, if I'm here, it's going to be no good. I'm going to be in big trouble. He ran out of the house. Now the sages tell us, you know, at this point then, you know, what now inspired Yosef? Especially because he went in actually to find her. So what turned him around? What was it? This is a famous quote from Chazal. They say that he saw in the window Demus Ziuknosh of his father's face, an image of his father. I mean, he was about to give in his desire, and then he had this perception, this vision of his father in the window, and that motivated him to say no and run away. So what does that mean? So on the one hand, it means that Yosef seemingly had enough respect and enough self-control at the moment, he was able to conjure up his father. That's number one. I mean, seemingly, I would assume it doesn't mean that it wasn't a prophetic vision. It was Yosef in his own mind trying to do whatever he could to get out of this mess and to get out of there. But I think for a more practical and deeper way, what it means is that the values that of your home, the values you're taught as a child, the influences you have in your life, you know, your core principles and morals, they stick with you. Yosef has not been with his father for a long period of time at this point. But Yosef, the values of his father's home were so strong, were so powerful, that even at Yosef's time of his greatest challenge, he was able to conjure up those ideals, and he couldn't bring himself to do the act because of it. I mean, there's some things to us that are so basic, they're so fundamental to who we are, that we can't bring ourselves to cross that line. We have to have our red lines in life, but often those red lines are red lines that come from our upbringing. The values that we are taught as kids, both by our parents and by our teachers and role models. But those values become so innate to us that, you know, they stick with us. So that vision stuck with Yosef. And when he was about to give in, he couldn't cast off the vision of his father, the holiness of Yaakov Avinu. And he said, how can I, a child of Yaakov, get involved in such a terrible, terrible sin? You know, you have a beautiful story, a very tragic story, which is discussed in Kinos on Tisha B'Av. And the story is of the daughter and son of Rishmael Ben Elisha, I believe, who they call him Gadol. And the two of them, you know, this is talking about the destruction of Beis Hamikdash, two of them were sold into slavery. And Rabbi Shmuel was known as an extremely beautiful person, and his children were very, very beautiful children. So the two masters, one master bought his son, one bought his daughter, and they didn't realize they were related. And one master said to the other, I have this gorgeous Hebrew slave. Another one said, I have one too. He said, let's put them together. They'll have children, and we will have all these beautiful, strong slaves that we can divide up between us. They said, great. So they stuck in a room together at night, expecting that they were slaves and that they would want to be together and, you know, and they would have children. But the rabbis tell us that both of them sat there in the corner crying, and they said, how could I, a child of Aaron HaKohen, you know, be intimate with this slave woman? And the girl said, how could I, a daughter of Yocheved, I think she said, how could I be with this slave man? And they spent the night in their own corners crying. In the morning, the sun came up, it was light. They saw my brother, my sister, they embraced and they died. But it's a tragic story. The beauty of the story is the two of them, they didn't say, okay, that's it. We give up, we're slaves, this is life. And, you know, forget about it. They looked back and said, how could I, a child, a Jewish child, a child of a Kohen, a child of Aaron HaKohen, how could I give in? How could I lose sight of my values and my morals? And that kept them. That's what kept them from doing a terrible, terrible sin. So Yosef the same way. How could I, the son of Yaakov, do such a thing? In our own lives, you know, besides our upbringing, which should give us, you know, basic values to live on, but visions of greatness, of great people, of great mentors or great role models, those visions remain for us really as models that even when we go through tough times, we should be able to have an image of them in our own minds. For many of us, you know, it could be a parent, it could be a grandparent, it could be a Rebbe, it could be a teacher, it could be a friend. There's people out there that we always can envision. And you say, well, you know, what would this person do? What would this person say? What would this person think? If you have those models in your life, those can carry you through challenges in ways that your own personal, just the ideals, don't carry you through. Many people, you know, it could be a person, you know, God forbid, loses a parent, but that parent stands for them as the model of strength, morality, or values. And you take that vision and, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, and it sticks with you. And it carries you through so much because that's such a powerful part of your life. So Yosef had that. His father and him were extremely close when he was young. The relationship was there. And when it came down to it, even though Yosef was just about to give in, he said no. He picked Yaakov Avinu, He said, how could I, a child of Yaakov, do this? And he ran away. It's a very powerful part of the story. What happened afterwards is that he runs out, and if you look at verse 13, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called out to the men of the household and spoke to them, saying, look, he brought us a Hebrew man to sport with us. He came to lie with me, but I called out with a loud scream. So she starts blaming him. You know, she doesn't want to get in trouble. So she starts he runs out and leaves his clothes behind. So something's going on over here. So she calls out and says, this Hebrew slave tried to make a pass at me. And what happens eventually is that it gets back to her husband, and he throws Yosef into prison. Now, it's very interesting. The Sforno, one of the classic commentators, says that ultimately Potiphar didn't believe his wife. Potiphar knew that his wife also was involved in these types of things, and he didn't really believe her. He imprisoned Yosef just in his wife's honor, just to kind of give lip service to what she was saying. But he didn't believe his wife 100%, which probably is why he didn't kill Yosef. I mean, imagine, you're an Egyptian slave owner. Your slave makes a pass at your wife. I mean, I don't think he would hesitate to kill the slave. That's that thing. He didn't kill him. He put him in prison. And he put him to the royal prison. No, he put him in the royal prison. So Sforno says he didn't really believe his wife, but ultimately he did put Yosef in prison just to kind of placate her. But it wasn't that he really believed her. He was put into, as I said before, because Potiphar was royalty, Yosef was put into the royal prison. And in the royal prison, he was able to interact, we'll see soon, with other royal prisoners and people who from the royal court, which worked to Yosef's benefit in the future. But again, we find, if you look at verse 21, Hashem was with Yosef, he endowed him with charisma, and he put his favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So again, Yosef goes back to how he was before, meaning that he starts succeeding. Everyone sees that Hashem was with Yosef, and Yosef starts becoming the star prisoner in the prison. The prison warden placed all inmates of the prison in Yosef's custody. Everything that was done there, he would accomplish. So Yosef became the chief prisoner. Probably got some extra food out of it, probably got some extra special treatment out of it. Because this Hashem was with Yosef. Again, Yosef remained with Hashem, and Hashem remained with Yosef. And therefore, Yosef, whatever he touched, turned to gold. He always succeeded. The prison warden did not scrutinize anything that was in his charge, and as much as Hashem was with him, whatever he did, Hashem made successful. So in prison, it was clear that Hashem was with Yosef. He had a certain chen, a certain charm that everyone else saw, and he succeeded in prison. Rav Volbi says that when it says here that Hashem was with Yosef, it's a very important lesson to us. That even in the most extreme, dire circumstances, in the most mundane, unholy places, Hashem still remains with you. And Yosef is now thrown into an Egyptian prison, even more distant from his family, even more hopeless. Despite that, Hashem is with him, because Hashem can be with you no matter where you are. Don't say, oh, I'm stuck here in this foreign land, in this place of impurity. There's no way Hashem is going to help me out over here. Mochart's kavodo, Hashem's honor is everywhere. Hashem's glory is everywhere. And he can help you no matter where you are. So let's stop there for the week. So Yosef now is left off. He first was a slave, and now he's in prison. So things seem to be getting worse and worse and worse for Yosef until the rest of the story next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great week.
Be well.